1. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, June 16, 1775, 8 a.m. George Washington is out for blood. 20 years almost to the day after Braddock's defeat, as the infamous battle in the Ohio River Valley has come to be known, the 6'2" Virginian pushes back his chair and rises to his feet. 70-year-old Benjamin Franklin watches him from across the cramped assembly room here in the Pennsylvania State House. Delegates to the Second Continental Congress sit in high-backed chairs, their papers splayed before them on cloth-covered tables, waiting to hear if Washington will accept the new title he has been offered. At the head of the room on this oppressively humid Friday morning, overseeing the proceedings, sits John Hancock, the wealthiest man in Massachusetts and president of the Congress. A man of medium height and build, he is 38 and soon to be married, with a baby already on the way. Born the son of a clergyman, Hancock was sent to live with a rich uncle at the age of 7, after his father had died and his mother could no longer care for him. The uncle had no children of his own, so Hancock was raised to take over the family's highly successful import-export business. In time, Hancock added to his growing wealth by becoming a smuggler of wine, tea, molasses, and tobacco. His duties as president of the Congress are slight, most often mediating debate. On days when the arguments become loud enough for people outside the tall windows ringing the assembly room to hear what is being said, Hancock might insist that they be kept closed. But this morning, thanks to the temperature and thick morning air, they are wide open. Footnote: construction on the Pennsylvania State House began in 1732, but was not completed for more than 20 years. At the time, it was one of the most ambitious buildings in the colonies. In 1824, the assembly room was rechristened the Hall of Independence, which was later shortened to Independence Hall, a name that became synonymous with the entire building. On February 22, 1861, President-elect Abraham Lincoln visited Independence Hall on his way to Washington, D.C. 4 years later, on April 22 through the 24th, 1865, Lincoln's body lay in state in the same room on its way back to Illinois for burial. More than 85,000 mourners filed through to pay their respects. A bronze marker indicates the spot where another fallen American president, John F. Kennedy, spoke while visiting Independence Hall on July 4, 1962. End footnote. Sitting on the aisle next to the second row of desks is Benjamin Franklin. He is weary but attentive, his impish sense of humor nowhere to be seen. Just 6 weeks ago, he returned home from 11 years in England. Unfortunately, his wife Deborah, who had remained in Philadelphia due to fear of ocean travel, had died during Franklin's absence. Shortly before last Christmas, she was felled by a stroke. Her husband got the news while living in a small brick row house between Charing Cross and the Strand in London. As much as he misses his wife, it is not her passing that lays the biggest burden on Franklin's heart. His original purpose for sailing to London had been to act on behalf of his home colony, seeking to establish a closer relationship between Pennsylvania and the British Crown. But the effort was soon overshadowed by England's exploitative policy of taxing the American colonies to pay British debts. Onerous legislation such as the Molasses Act, Sugar Act, and Townsend Acts forced the Americans to pay duties on everyday amenities such as rum, paper, paint, and glass, with all the revenue flowing to England, all to pay for the same frontier defenses the colonies already provided for themselves. The colonists believed this to be illegal. Even worse, there was no attempt to allow the colonists a voice in Parliament, leading many to fume that taxation without representation was a form of slavery. The Intolerable Acts of 1774 went a step further, punishing the people of Massachusetts by abolishing their provincial government and installing a British general as the colony's new governor. At first, the enraged colonists responded by actually beating tax collectors. With rebellion in the air, Franklin's focus changed. Instead of just Pennsylvania, he found himself representing all the colonies as a diplomat, working tirelessly to keep the peace. Franklin is not a timid man. He knows there is a time and a place for war. In 1755, shortly after Braddock's stunning annihilation left the colonies wide open to French and Indian attack, more than 400 white settlers were slaughtered and scalped in Pennsylvania. It was Franklin who led the call for a state militia to defend the people. His pleas were ignored until the bodies of those dead settlers were brought by wagon to Philadelphia and dumped on the steps of this very state house. 2 days later, Franklin had his army. In his efforts to prevent war between England and America, Franklin has made every effort to be impartial. "In England," he once wrote of the criticism thrown his way, "I am accused of being too much an American, and in America, of being too much an Englishman." Now, despite his diligent efforts, war has come. On April 19, 1775, shortly after he boarded a ship for the voyage home to America, the battles of Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts saw the first casualties of a conflict that would eventually become known as the Revolutionary War. Footnote: in England, it will become known as the War of American Independence. End footnote. On this very day, north of Boston, 1,200 colonial soldiers are hastily building defensive fortifications on the hills of the Charlestown Peninsula. Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill offer a commanding view of Boston, a city of 15,000 people and long a hotbed of loathing toward the British. The Crown has occupied Boston since 1768 as it tightened restrictions in the most rebellious of colonies, controlling the ebb and flow of daily life while carefully monitoring the growing divide between patriots, as the rebels call themselves, and the loyalists. There has been bloodshed as a result of this friction, most notably the Boston Massacre in 1770, when British soldiers fired into a patriot mob, killing 5 men. Currently, a force of 6,000 regulars is garrisoned within Boston's 1 square mile limits. Footnote: regulars are so called because they are career soldiers who serve on a daily basis rather than being called out only when needed. End footnote. Were it not for a thin stretch of land known as the Roxbury Neck, connecting it to the Massachusetts coastline, Boston would be an island. Colonial troops under Artemas Ward control access to the neck, forming a narrow barrier preventing the British from marching out of Boston and expanding their control of the surrounding towns. Yet, while the English may be contained, they are by no means cut off. They control Boston, which means that English ships come and go with impunity, resupplying the regular army garrison and preventing the military siege that would see British food and ammunition choked off. The Massachusetts colony has no navy to contest these vessels, many of which are armed with cannon. Thus, a stalemate has existed for months between the two forces, and continues to this day, despite the skirmishes at Lexington and Concord 2 months ago. If the British were to take control of Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill, the colonists would lose a key strategic position. From their lofty summits overlooking Boston Harbor and the city itself, the colonists can fire cannonballs, which is why the British have spent the last 3 weeks secretly plotting an invasion of the Charlestown Peninsula to capture those heights. But just 2 days ago, on June 13th, the rebels got word of the British plans. Working day and night, they have been preparing redoubts from which to fend off the redcoats. 6 feet high, made of earth, with wooden platforms on the interior from which men can stand to fire their muskets, the square-shaped fortifications are protected from assault by ditches around their perimeter. Early on the morning of June 17th, British warships fire on Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill to little effect. The emboldened colonists endure a sweltering day in the sun as they await the next move from the English. Soon, they spot longboats rowing soldiers from Boston over to the Charlestown Peninsula. The flotilla is massive, ferrying some 1,500 grenadiers and light infantry across the harbor. Some of the colonists quietly desert, retreating back toward Cambridge rather than facing sure death. Those who choose to remain will long remember the confusion of that day as the local militia volunteers mill about with a lack of military discipline, even as the British regulars fix their bayonets and prepare for the attack. The mere sight of them is daunting. Hundreds of red-coated soldiers stand abreast, lining up in four neat rows, prepared to launch a full frontal assault on the hastily built colonial defenses. When American snipers fired from buildings in the town of Charlestown, British cannon responded with red-hot shot, setting fire to the city and casting great plumes of smoke into the air. Yet it is the colonists who win the early stages of the fight, thanks to the strength of their defensive positions. Shooting with a sniper's precision, they pick off the English with ease. Many grenadier and infantry units lose almost all their men, some with only 8 or 9 men a company left, in the words of one English observer. It appears to be a stunning repeat of Braddock's defeat, a comparison made all the more apparent by the fact that the British commander, General Thomas Gage, served side by side with George Washington at that battle as another aide to Braddock. The first British attack stalls when the light infantry, attempting to turn the American flank, is decimated by fire from a barrier on the shoreline. A second assault fares only slightly better. The British entered the battle believing the colonists would run at the first smell of gunpowder. Their arrogance has been costly. The grenadiers' advance slowed by fences and other obstacles that disarray their columns and allow them to be cut to ribbons by the fortified colonial positions. Dead redcoats lie sprawled in the dense grass just outside the American fortifications. The wounded and the dying cry for help, but their pleas go unanswered. As afternoon turns to evening, however, the colonists run out of ammunition. Only then does the tide of the battle turn toward the British. The colonists' muskets, used more often for hunting dinner than killing men, lack bayonets. So, as the professional soldiers come over the parapets during the third English assault in late afternoon, the combatants resort to hand-to-hand fighting, and the battle swings toward the English. Having no other choice, the colonists retreat, leaving Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill to the British. They flee toward Cambridge, where they will have safety in numbers, some getting caught by British bayonets, but most escaping. The retreat is orderly and precise, saving the lives of hundreds of colonists and preventing their imprisonment. And while they have lost what will become known as the Battle of Bunker Hill, the men of Massachusetts have extracted a fierce toll. Almost 800 wounded and more than 200 dead, including a large number of officers. Most astounding, almost half of all British soldiers entering this battle are now casualties. Sir William Howe, a British general newly arrived from England, will report this shocking news back to London. "When I look to the consequences of it, in the loss of so many brave officers, I do it with horror. The success is too dearly bought." All the fighting in Boston will take place tomorrow. Right now, the Continental Congress is deciding who will form and lead the American army. "Resolved," the minutes of its June 15th meeting read, "that a general be appointed to command all continental forces raised or to be raised for the defense of American liberty, that $500 a month be allowed for his pay and his expenses." Footnote: more than $15,000 per month in modern currency. End footnote. Though the salary is lavish, the obstacles to success are many. Enthusiasm for the fight is high throughout the colonies, but most potential soldiers prefer to remain close to home, serving with their local militia, taking orders from friends and relatives. The idea of fighting in a continental army, obeying the directives of strangers and waging war hundreds of miles from their families, is distasteful. It will be the role of the new general to convince those uneducated and unsophisticated men that accepting his commands is in their best interest. Then, of course, there is the harsh penalty for failure. If the new commander-in-chief can successfully raise, train, feed, clothe, and equip an army, he must still find a way to defeat the British regulars, widely considered the world's greatest fighting force. Should he lose, this new general will not merely be placed in captivity as a prisoner of war, he will be treated as a traitor to the British crown and hanged for high treason. This will not, however, be an ordinary hanging. High treason is considered the greatest capital crime a man can commit against the King of England. The punishment is extraordinary, ensuring a slow and hideous death. It will begin when the accused is tied to a horse and dragged to the gallows. He will then be hanged by the neck, but cut down before he dies so that he remains alive for what comes next, which is the slicing open of his abdomen and the burning of his intestines as they dangle outside his body. Only then will this general have his head cut off. His corpse will then be cut up into four parts, all of which will be delivered to the king. But the punishment will not end there. All lands and monies will be confiscated from this unlucky man's estate. His wife and children will be forever forbidden from purchasing property or owning a business. And, of course, if the general's wife should also be accused of treason for conspiring with her husband, she will be burned alive. Ben Franklin no longer has a wife, but as he looks around the cramped assembly room on this June morning, he is well aware that simply attending this seditious meeting to discuss waging war against the crown is grounds for high treason. It is not just the new general who stands to stretch a rope, but every single delegate in the room. Simply traveling to Philadelphia to attend the Congress was an act of great courage, for a recent smallpox epidemic in the city killed 300 men, women, and children. Footnote: Philadelphia's population at the time was approximately 30,000. The bulk of the city was located along the waterfront, while the area now known as Independence Hall was several blocks inland, close to what was then the city's outskirts. End footnote. With no assurances that the outbreak has passed, the delegates entered the city to take part in the uncertain business of forging a nation. The problem facing these men now, even after war has broken out, is that Georgia, not yet believing fully in the cause of independence, has refused to send a delegate to this convention. In other words, the 13 colonies are still unwilling to stand together as one to fight for their common future. It is Franklin who will sound the ominous reminder of their fate if this does not change. "We must indeed all hang together, or most assuredly, we will all hang separately." Despite the long odds against defeating England, a number of men have stepped forward to apply for the generalship. Candidates include the slovenly British-born Lieutenant Colonel Charles Lee, a man with a temper so fierce that during the French and Indian War, the Iroquois nicknamed him Aonawaterika, boiling water. Lee is missing two fingers, thanks to a dueling accident, and has a passion for prostitutes that will one day be his undoing. Another candidate is Artemus Ward, a fiery, heavy-set 47-year-old Bostonian who is presently commanding the forces at Bunker Hill. Ward, who suffers frequent bouts of ill health, enjoys a reputation as a military leader so illustrious that Massachusetts has appointed him commander-in-chief of the Grand American Army, as the collection of local militias has been nicknamed by the press. However, the most popular choice is the genteel John Hancock. Despite a lack of military experience, the Massachusetts native feels that his service as president of this Congress entitles him to be appointed commander-in-chief. He is a man born to privilege, fond of expensive wine, dancing, and the pursuit of life's many pleasures. Rather than simply travel on horseback, for instance, Hancock drives a carriage pulled by 6 matching bay-colored horses. His mode of dress is shocking in its garishness. He wore a coat of scarlet, lined with silk, and a white satin embroidered waistcoat, dark satin small clothes, white silk stockings, and shoes with silver buckles, one observer wrote. John Hancock presumed he would be given the title of Commander-in-Chief as thanks for his serving as President of this Congress. In fact, he presumes many things, thinking himself worthy of almost every great honor. Ironically, Hancock is not in favor of colonial independence. He is a hardened Anglophile who spent 4 years in London learning to run the House of Hancock, the family business that revolves around the sale of British goods to the colonies, in particular, whale oil. His loyalty to the British throne led him to attend the London funeral of King George II in November 1760, and then remain in England for the coronation of the current monarch, George III, 10 months later. In truth, Hancock has more to lose than almost any other man in this room. His livelihood depends on the freedom of the high seas, allowing his ships to smuggle Dutch tea and French molasses into the colonies. The outbreak of war will see an end to that. John Hancock will never be a pauper, but he will also never see the heights of wealth he knew before the disruption in trade caused by the war with Great Britain. There are, in fact, 3 deeply divided factions within the Second Continental Congress, all with separate ideas about America's future. The more conservative group longs for a return to traditional ties with England. The most radical group, led by John Adams, argues for complete independence, although they rarely discuss this in public, for the notion is so outlandish as to border on heretical. The most popular faction, of which Hancock is a member, wants to maintain ties with England, but considers the British Parliament corrupt and duplicitous and believes it has no authority in the colonies. These men want America to report directly to George III, whom they see as their ally and dear friend. Hancock believes a strong military statement might achieve that end. Because Hancock is not totally in favor of separation, Delegate John Adams of Massachusetts is uncomfortable with him forming a Continental Army and leading it into battle. He is also of the belief that the support of the southern colonies is vital to defeating the British. Rather than select Ward or Hancock, both of whom hail from Adams's home state, Adams has persuaded his cousin, the fiery Samuel Adams, to help him nominate George Washington as the man to lead the Continental Army. Washington is known for his military bearing and rational behavior. The fact that he hails from Virginia will definitely bring about a tighter colonial alliance. Thus, 2 days ago, John Adams stood to address the delegates. He and Hancock have known each other since childhood, and it was Hancock's father who baptized the newborn John Adams in 1735. As a beaming Hancock looked on, believing his friend was about to nominate him, the loquacious Adams opened his remarks by speaking of the state of the colonies and the need to appoint a general. Then Adams shocked the room, stating that a gentleman from Virginia should lead the new army. Suddenly, John Hancock's demeanor changed. "I never remarked a sudden or more striking change of countenance," John Adams would later write about Hancock. "Mortification and resentment were expressed as forcibly as his face could exhibit them." As the room exploded into debate, George Washington immediately left so he would be out of earshot as the delegates discussed the matter. The following day, another motion was made to name the 43-year-old Washington Commander-in-Chief. A newcomer to the Continental Congress, Thomas Jefferson, seconded the motion. Footnote: the man who nominated Washington was the remarkable Thomas Johnson of Maryland, 42 at the time, Johnson would later go on to lead troops in the Revolutionary War, serve as the first governor of Maryland once it became a state, serve as a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, and insist that a new national capital known as Federal City be renamed in honor of George Washington. End footnote. In a letter to his wife Martha, Washington will declare that he never lobbied for the job, stating that, "Far from seeking this appointment, I have used every endeavor in my power to avoid it." That is not true. Franklin and the other 55 delegates have been quite aware of Washington's burning desire to lead the rebel army, primarily out of boredom. Washington needs action. His ambition is impossible to ignore. Nowhere has this been more in evidence than in his choice of clothing. Every day since arriving in Philadelphia 1 month ago, the 43-year-old Virginian has dressed in a blue military uniform quite similar in design to his battle dress at Braddock's defeat. No other delegate dresses in this manner. And although that battle took place 20 years ago next month, the uniform is a reminder to everyone that Washington is a seasoned warrior. It was he who oversaw Braddock's burial those many years ago, and then ordered the remaining British soldiers to trample back and forth over the dirt to hide the grave from the French and Indians, lest they exhume the body. Washington has done well for himself militarily since Braddock's defeat, returning to the Ohio River Valley as part of another British force in 1758, this time winning the battle and wresting territory from the French. He has also climbed the social ladder. Also in 1758, he rekindled his love for a wealthy, dark-eyed, British-born member of Virginia society, the beautiful 28-year-old Sally Fairfax. Washington's passion for the fairer sex is well known, with his friends even giving him the nickname the Stallion of the Potomac. However, his status as a planter and surveyor saw him rebuffed by two wealthy young women in his early 20s. In the case of Sally Fairfax, the affection was mutual, yet the affair was doomed from the start, for Washington was not wealthy enough at the time to be a suitable match. More important, Sally was already married to one of his good friends. Footnote. Although there is no proof the couple consummated their relationship, Washington openly professed his love to Mrs. Fairfax in writing. "The world has no business to know the object of my love, declared in this manner to you," he stated in a secret letter to Fairfax while engaged to Martha Custis. Sally Fairfax visited Washington and Martha frequently after their marriage, but moved to England with her husband George William Fairfax in 1773. She remained there long after Fairfax's death. In 1798, Washington wrote her, urging a return to Virginia, reminding her of "those happy moments, the happiest of my life, that I have enjoyed in your company." She ignored him, dying alone in England in 1811. End footnote. Instead, Washington took the widowed Martha Dandridge Custis for his bride in 1759. The marriage elevated Washington into the highest levels of colonial society. This was no accident. Washington was so keen to woo the rich young widow that he took a break from his military career in March 1758 to pay a visit to her home, just 8 short months after the death of her husband. Martha was smitten by the tall man who arrived at her house that day with his reddish-brown hair carefully powdered. 9 days after their first meeting, he proposed. Soon after, Martha ordered a wedding dress from a shop in London. The dress itself was modest, as a reminder that she had just ended a time of mourning. She also purchased purple slippers for the occasion, as a symbol of the new joy she had found with the gallant Washington. 1 foot shorter and 8 months older than her second husband, the plump and pretty Martha is known for her charm and iron will. Her home is called White House, a Virginia tobacco plantation of 17,500 acres holding more than 300 slaves. But George and Martha choose to live at a smaller estate, one passed to Washington upon the death of his half-brother Lawrence. Mount Vernon, as it is known, is a 6,500-acre parcel of land that requires more than 100 slaves to function smoothly. Footnote: in 1759, Mount Vernon was approximately 3,170 acres. Over the next 30-plus years, Washington added various parcels of land that increased the size to almost 7,600 acres. End footnote. The combined population of all 13 colonies is 2.5 million, of which 500,000 are slaves, one in five people. At the time of the Second Continental Congress, George Washington owns 135 men, women, and children. His wife's slaves are her separate property. Footnote: shortly after Washington's death, a series of suspicious fires was set at Mount Vernon. This led many to believe that his slaves were growing restless. Martha granted them their freedom on January 1, 1801, and many said it was because she feared for her life. However, by law, she could not free the slaves she had inherited from her first husband 40 years earlier. These individuals were passed down to her heirs upon her death. End footnote. The 16 years of retirement from the military since the French and Indian War have become a time of prosperity for Washington. He has become one of the wealthiest men in the colonies. The one great disappointment in his life is that he has not fathered any children. He refuses to admit that he is the problem, blaming it instead on Martha. But the truth is that Washington is likely sterile due to his teenage bout of smallpox. Footnote: Martha was first married to Daniel Park Custis, 20 years her senior, when she was just 18 years old. He died in 1757 after 7 years of marriage. Martha gave birth to 4 children during that time. However, even in an age when fewer than 60% of children lived to the age of 20, the deaths of her 2 oldest children before they turned 5 was a staggering loss. Martha's 2 remaining children, John Park Jackie Custis and Martha Park Patsy Custis, lived to see her marry George Washington. However, Patsy died of seizures in 1773 at the age of 17. Jackie Custis died in 1781 at the age of 26. End footnote. Back in Philadelphia, Washington is a man in need of a challenge. Wealth and power are not enough. He is a man of action. He remembers the lessons in drill and tactics he learned during his time with the British Army. He knows where to place troops on the battlefield and how to exploit an enemy's weaknesses. This belief in himself gives Washington an inner strength that is evident to the delegates. "He seems discreet and virtuous," notes Connecticut lawyer Eliphalet Dyer. "No harum-scarum ranting, swearing fellow, but sober, steady, and calm." John Adams, a man known for his dour outlook, is also taken with Washington's disposition. "Something charming to me in the conduct of Washington. A gentleman of one of the first fortunes on the continent, leaving his delicious retirement, his family and friends, sacrificing his ease, and hazarding all in the cause of his country." So, just as George Washington once rode through the night to gain assistance for General Braddock's defeated army, he has now made the decision to put his life on the line fighting the British. The vote has been counted. The choice is unanimous. Washington will have his chance to defeat England on the battlefield. "As the Congress desire it, I will enter upon the momentous duty and exert every power I possess in their service and for support of the glorious cause," he tells the assembled delegates as he accepts his command. Then, in a move that the frugal Ben Franklin admires tremendously, the wealthy and powerful Washington says he will do it all for free. "As to pay, sir," Washington continues, "I beg leave to assure the Congress that as no pecuniary consideration could have tempted me to have accepted this arduous employment, at the expense of my domestic ease and happiness, I do not wish to make any profit from it." General Washington leaves for Boston in the morning. 3 weeks later, on July 8th, the Georgians finally decide to send delegates to Philadelphia and formally ally themselves with those fighting the war against England.